Good morning and welcome to WNHH Radio's High Haven program about everything Jewish in our community. And speaking of everything Jewish in our community, the long-awaited Volume 10 of a great series of books entitled Jews of New Haven is hot off the presses, folks. And today in the WNHH studio, we have with us the man who made it possible. Say good morning to Dr. David S. Fisher. Welcome to the studio, Mr. Fisher. So nice to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Paul. Thank you for inviting me.
So the Jews of New Haven, for people who don't know, they're one of these wonderful thick volumes of stories that people contribute about synagogues, other Jewish institutions, people in New Haven's history, living and long dead. And there have been 10 now with the new edition that Dr. Fisher has just edited and authored. They're put out by the Jewish Historical Society of Greater New Haven, which is a very active society. They're part of the ethnic archives at Southern, and they just have walls and walls and boxes full of great history in New Haven. They put on great events. And Jews in New Haven is one that I'm very proud as a New Haven Jew to be part of a community that produces these books. I've learned so much about New Haven from reading them. And Dr. Fisher, I guess you too, because when we were looking at how you got involved in this, you came to the Milford, in 1978. You're an oncologist, and you picked up an early edition of Jews in New Haven, right? And that got you connected and interested in the Jewish community here. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The Historical Society was started in 76 by Harvey Layden, a native of New Haven. In 1978, they decided to publish some of the material that Harvey and Judith Schiff and others had collected, including Rabbi Scheel, and they enlisted Jonathan Sarna, who was then a graduate student in history at
Yale.
He's
now a big game named nationally. I guess he's a Brandeis in Jewish.
He's a Brandeis and probably the preeminent historian of Jewish history at the present time. And I picked up his volume one, and I was fascinated by it. It had a bunch of little articles about people. Meyer Zunder, who was a very well-known settler in the 1840s.
Actually, I learned more about him in your new book. Read the original one, and he was in the 1840s, came, and he had a store, I guess a grocery store, but he was on the Board of Ed for many years, a Jew back then when it wasn't as common to have Jews in leadership positions.
Right.
And he visited every classroom, he said, in the city. And he also was an early opponent of racial segregation, I guess.
That's right. And he became the head of the Board of Education. And later, they named a school for him, the Meyer Zunder School. It was an elementary school in New Haven. And we have a picture of it in Volume 10. Actually, Meyer Zunder is the only person we've written about twice, in Volume 1 and now in Volume 10, a follow-up by his great-granddaughter.
And that's one thing I love about the books. I do read about people I know because you have some living people. But when I read about Meyer Zunder in the 1800s, I get a flavor of what New Haven's like. Or one of the earlier books has a whole piece, the only really existing piece of any length on New Haven's only Jewish mayor.
That's right.
Samuel Campner in the early 1900s, about 100 years ago, he served a year. His portrait's up on the third floor of City Hall. And I got a sense sort of what it was like to be Jewish and to be in New Haven and all these different parts in our history. With Meyer Zunder, I see the picture of the school. It no longer exists. When you have your old pictures of the stores and the synagogues that are on Grand Avenue, the early Michigan Israel offshoot on Olive Street, in the hill, I love being transported back. I feel almost like you've taken me on a trip to my own parts of my own city I never explored before.
Well, what's remarkable about it is that the first seven volumes were edited by three people, or four, actually. The first one was by Jonathan Sarna. The second one was by Barry Herman. And then Barry Herman and Werner Hirsch collaborated to edit the third edition. The fourth edition was to be edited by Harvey Layden, who founded the society, and he enlisted Rene Craw, who was a managing editor of a scientific magazine called Radiocarbon, to help him. And during the course of his editorship, he became ill and died, and Rene completed the book. And then she went on to edit the fifth volume with the help of Werner Hirsch. Werner Hirsch went on to do the sixth volume. Barry Herman did the seventh. And this was all great. And when I moved to Milford from Orange, I became president of the Summer Synagogue in Milford, the Hebrew Congregation of Woodmont. And after 12 years of that, I thought that I looked at the 33 synagogues that Sarna had written about, and he had not included Milford because at the time, the Jewish Historical Society only included New Haven and contiguous cities, and Milford is not contiguous.
And now we're defining New Haven as broader, which has a modern part to the story too, because you're talking about Milford, we're talking about Woodbridge, Orange, Bethany. There are towns that Jews move west to after urban renewal in the mid-20th century. And what we're hearing a lot about now is how Jews are moving from the west of New Haven to the east of New Haven. And as the Jewish Community Center, after a fire there last year, they had a lot of community-wide discussions about where the future of the community would be, where should the institutional anchors of the community be located. And we heard that a lot of people have moved to the eastern shoreline, towns like Madison, Clinton, Brantford. So I guess we're defining not just the Jewish Historical Society, but the New Haven Jewish community itself seems to be casting a wider net geographically.
Yes, that's correct. And what I did when it came to writing the story for Milford, I went to Barry Herman to give him the story for Volume 8. And Barry said he was ill and he couldn't do Volume 8. And he decided to have me do Volume 8. And that's how I got into the business. I did not seek this. But
that's how it always works in civic organizations. Yeah. People agree to take on a chore and it becomes a labor of love, right?
Right. And so I edited Volume 8. And what I did was I looked back at what Sarna had done. And he had described 33 synagogues. Synagogue buildings of 20 different congregations that had existed in New Haven itself. And over the years, with subsequent issues, some of these synagogues were mentioned, but mostly the stories in the early first seven volumes were about individuals and what they remembered about organizations and their families and other things. And so I decided in Volume 7 to cast a wider net. Milford was outside the contiguous area, there was the Hebrew Congregation of Woodmont, and there was also a prior congregation, Bnei Israel, in Milford, which had become defunct and folded into Or Shalom.
And you've kept that going. In the new edition, the 10th, Dr. Fisher, you have a story that I found very interesting about a congregation in Cheshire called Kol Ami.
Yes.
I'd been to that synagogue, it's a Reform synagogue, and it lasted only 15 years. It sounded from the story like it was quite a lively 15 years. They started in 1998, I guess an offshoot from Waterbury maybe, and they closed in 2014. When you look at that, so the history's gone. I mean, it's over. The story has ended of that, but the history's not over because we preserved it here. What is the value of a congregation that's in existence only 15 years, and why is it important that we have a Jewish history book that tells that story?
Well, it's important to know where we came from and what we've done before so that we'll know what we need to do now and in the future. Kol Ami was a very active congregation. Jerry Geniza, who wrote the article, is now a member of Temple Beth Shalom in Hamden. And as a matter of fact, this past Saturday, she did the Haftorah, which was commemoration of the first Haftorah she ever did, which was 30 years ago. So people of Kol Ami didn't disappear. They just went to other places. Kol Ami was actually conservative synagogue in Cheshire. Beth David is the Reform congregation in Cheshire, and there's also an article on Beth David.
Why do you think Kol Ami went out of business? There obviously was a need. It got bigger very quickly. They actually got money together to get a space all decked out. They got people to the services. Why in 98 was there a need for a conservative synagogue in Cheshire, and why in 2014 was there no longer a need?
The two major reasons, I think, and Jerry in her article alludes to them. One was that the group that formed it was a young group, and they had children, and they needed a religious school, and they wanted their children to be bar and bat mitzvahed. That was the first thing. And after that happened, the need, after the children were bar and bat mitzvahed, their need diminished. And
we see that often with synagogues. Some
exactly.
people, especially suburbs, join just to have to be there when the kids are having B'nai Mitzvah celebrations. But other people, it's a lifelong cycle. Some people care about the daily ritual, including conservative synagogues. Some people, it's very important to have daily minyan or weekly Shabbat services. But I'm thinking demographically here.
Yeah, the second
reason. The cycle often is that people get too old, and that's why people die off and you don't have a congregation. But wouldn't these people be replenished by other young Jews, or they just weren't their Jew, or they're not young Jewish families moving into the area?
Yeah, there was a demographic departure from the area, and it hit Kol Ami more than it hit Beth David.
What was the demographic chance? Young Jews or young conservative Jews weren't moving into that area?
That's right.
But they were for a while.
They were for a while, but they were moving out for economic opportunities elsewhere. Remember, Connecticut population has been going down.
Right.
And people, particularly in active people, are moving to areas where there are more jobs, whether it be
And yet my synagogue's gotten bigger. Beth El-Kasser is there. I mean, it almost went out of business, got smaller when older members died off in the, they were considered merging or closing down in the early 90s, late 80s. But since then, it's had a renaissance with lots of new, younger families and two generations of young families now.
Yes, and a very significant proportion of those are Yalies. You're living very close to Yale. It's walking distance and everything
Westville.
Else.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's some Yale connection. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I went to Yale, but I settled long, it was long after I graduated from Yale. My family settled there and some of the others. But, yeah.
I'm sure you have faculty members and students and... other people.
I don't think
who,
students. Okay, but people who settled, some of them had some Yale connection. Yeah.
Graduate students.
Yeah.
I mean,
and Yale's
have,
the big hire now. I mean, so the big industry in New Haven is Yale and Yale New Haven Hospital. So you have seen people coming for the hospital.
Yeah, a lot of doctors are.
But a lot of those people also live on the shoreline, which is, I guess, why we're seeing some growth in the shoreline. Temple Beth Tikva in Madison. Is that also growing?
Yes, we have an article on Temple Beth Tikva, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year.
Rabbi Offner is doing a great job there.
Yes, she is. And also we have an article on a synagogue in Chester, which is an amalgamation of three former synagogues from Moody's and Deep River and Chester, which is doing very well. And
is that the Saul DeWitt? Is that the Saul DeWitt synagogue, design synagogue, or am I missing one other one on the shoreline?
No, that's the one, and that's has a picture in volume 10 of a beautiful synagogue. It's beautiful on the outside, and it's also beautiful on the inside. It's actually been shown in architectural magazines. It's so special.
And what's the name? Is that Roadface Sedek?
Roadface.
Page 44?
It's
And is that Reform?
That's Reform. It's Congregation Beth Shalom Roadface Sedek. Nice article by Ellen Nodelman. And we have pictures of the synagogues that preceded it.
We're talking about New Haven's continuing Jewish history here on High Haven, WNHH Radio's program about everything Jewish in our community. My name is Paul Bass, and our guest today is David Fisher, who has edited and authored a new 10th volume of Jews in New Haven, the series put out by the Jewish Historical Society of Greater New Haven. So let's talk about how you got into this, Dr. Fisher. You're an oncologist. You're a very busy man. You were president of the staff at the former St. Raphael's Hospital. You were the president of New Haven Medical Association. You still, at 87 years old, in addition to doing these books, you co-chair Yale Cancer Center's Cancer Committee. You were the president of Beker Holim Sheves Achim, and then you were the president of, as you mentioned, for 12 years, Hebrew Congregation Woodmont. You're basically someone who exemplifies what the political scientist Doug Ray calls civic density, the kind of people who make up the fabric of a community by not just at their jobs, but in how they get involved in organizations that keep us vibrant. Well, it sounds like Jews in New Haven, when you first came upon it in 78, the first volume was your gateway drug to involvement in greater New Haven's Jewish community. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's a fair way to put it, yeah. But remember, the Torah commands us to be involved. We have to do the mitzvot that God has commanded us. And that's basically civic involvement and helping those who need help.
It also means sitting through a lot of long, boring meetings just to make sure the organization's run.
But remember,
I admire people who do that. I have a low tolerance for that.
Well, remember what Jeremiah told the people who were exiled to Babylon, that they should work for the city in which they live and contribute to it, and the peace of the city will be the peace for them. And I think that's been what Jews have done or should be doing whenever they go to new places. And that's what the people, the German Jews who came in 1830s and 1840s did when they established Mishkan Israel, which incidentally was a very Orthodox synagogue in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, and didn't become Reformed until 1898.
And then Eastern European wave was 1880 to 1910 around?
Yeah, and that's when you got B'nai Jacob, which also started as a strictly Orthodox synagogue and didn't become conservative until about 1923, 24.
So the Germans went to Mishkan Israel over on Audubon Street, First Olive Street Audubon, and then am I right that the Eastern Europeans tended to go more to B'nai Jacob down near where the Walgreens is now by Yom Lehuin Hospital, but York and George, the
right,
son, right?
Right. And of course, Mishkan Israel broke into two synagogues, Mishkan Israel and B'nai Shalom. B'nai Shalom was supposedly Orthodox, while supposedly Mishkan Israel became Reform. But Mishkan Israel did not become Reform until 1898.
And when did they get their building that's now the Educational Center for the Arts at Audubon and Orange?
1898.
Oh, that's when that was. Okay.
Yes. And that's when they became Reform. Until that time, they were Orthodox, and people forget that.
One of my favorite stories in this book, both reading the story and hearing how you got it, was about, and this involves the early days of Mishkan Israel, the development of the mikveh, which are the ritual baths in our Jewish community. Observant Jewish communities have them. Women go there every month after they're finished menstruating, and then they're ritually cleaned to have sex with their husbands. The men go there often before a holiday or Shabbos to get ritually clean themselves, or if they have an emission in the evening and they want to be pure. So you did some detective work here, Dr. Fisher, when you did this book, because the records weren't that easy to find. You, in fact, found one contradiction in a key fact about the history, and you tracked it down that we've had a total of 6 mikvahs in different places since, I guess we have 3 now that exist, since the first one. And tell me how you found the first one was going to be done by Congregation Mishkan Israel when it became the first congregation, when it got permission from the state that you were allowed to have a Jewish congregation in the early 1800s. But then you discovered that that one never got built and a different one got built. How did that happen?
Well, as I say, the Mishkan Israel women and men were Orthodox, and the women wanted to have a mikveh. And Mishkan Israel appropriated $600 to build a mikveh.
What year was that?
That was 1849. And they sent a group of 3 people to New York to look at it and to get the plans for it and come back. For one reason or another, that was not built. And so a women's organization...
But before we get to that, yep. It was not built. I might remember this wrong. Was there an absence of records of why that didn't get built because Mishkan Israel had a fire and
yes.
Those records were destroyed?
That's correct. Okay. It wasn't built, so far as we know. And the women had an organization named Ahavath Achos, which is...
Lover of brothers.
Sisterly love. Sisterly love. And it was mostly women from Mishkan Israel, but it was not formally affiliated. They wanted to be independent. Even then, women wanted to be independent. And they decided they wanted a mikveh, and if Mishkan Israel wouldn't build it, they would build it. And so they appropriated $500 to build a mikveh.
How did you come to the conclusion that their decision was if Mishkan Israel wouldn't build it? I mean, that's the role of the historian, to look at the record and then draw inferences that you need to be confident of. Do you think Mishkan Israel, you saw that Mishkan Israel, there's no record that they did build it.
Right.
What led you to believe that the women concluded Mishkan Israel is not going to do it, so we got to do it?
Well, I'm not sure they concluded Michigan Israel wouldn't do it. They wanted it, and so they put up their money. They put their money where their mouth was. They put up $500, and we have
real money back then.
And we have records that they bought a piece of land on Gough Street to build it.
Where on Gough?
I don't know exactly, but they bought a piece of land for $25, which was big money in those days, and they built it. And
what year was that built?
1863.
Okay, so 1863 it opens.
It opens.
And there's a on Gough Street. And then how long did that one stay in?
We don't know. We do know that the second one was built by the Eastern European Jews on Oak Street, about 1890.
And Oak Street is at the edge of what's today the hill near Yale New Haven Hospital.
Yeah, what's now Martin Luther King,
Boulevard. And it was back in the day, a lot of Jews and
that was the heart of the
Jewish Americans and Irish Americans and to some extent African Americans lived in the hill.
And Italians.
First entry point for immigrant communities.
Right.
And some people call it the slums, other people look back at it and say, what a lively, great melting pot. But in any case, there was a ritual bath. And what I was interested in reading between the lines in your book, Dr. Fisher, is that the way you found out about it, it seemed like, was looking through the records of a congregation called Beker Holim, which used to be on something called Factory Street, which no longer exists, where Temple Medical Center is now. And was it parallel to George, or did it intersect George?
It crossed George.
From George down to Oak, at a little hill one block. Right now, I think that's a driveway to the parking area in between the building, Temple Medical, and the parking area. And at one end, there was Beker Holim, I believe. And on the other end, down the hill of the same block, was Shevis Achim,
right.
And eventually those two merged, and now they're in Westville, though I don't know how much longer that shul has. They have trouble getting a minion. But in any case, you looked through their records, and you saw a reference in those records to their Oak Street, T-H-E-I-R, mikveh, and that there was no other record of an Oak Street mikveh, but that when you saw there, you took the antecedent, and that there referred to a women's organization that was affiliated with the Beker Holim congregation.
Right.
And from that, you discovered that there was a second mikveh on Oak Street.
Yes.
That's pretty good detective work.
And we also found that when the Rose Street Shul first opened in 1895, a woman named Hurwitz contributed the first Torah, and it points out that she contributed the first Torah, and she was the mikveh lady.
So again, you found a reference that was was describing unrelated information, but in it to it you saw a reference to that. So she discovered she was the mikveh lady, meaning the woman who worked at the mikveh to tell you, certify that yell kosher if you've been dipped when people get converted to Judaism to go in the mikveh, and the mikveh lady yells kosher and all that, the witnesses. And let's tell you about the Rose Street Shul, which was on a street that no longer exists, what is now Yale New Haven Hospital's area, a small street, and it had an Orthodox shul that later broke off into two synagogues that we have today in Westville that moved after urban renewal. One is Beth El Kezer Israel Becky, a conservative synagogue on Harrison Street, and the other is the Westville Synagogue on West Prospect. But what I love is the role of the historian, the detective, David Fisher. You saw those two references, and from that, you concluded there was a second mikveh on downtown on Oak Street in the late 1800s.
I speculated that there's a second mikveh. I couldn't prove it.
But when
It said Rachel Horowitz, known as Bobby Rasha, a midwife and keeper of the mikveh, donated the first Torah to the new shul, the Rose Street Shul.
So, didn't you tie that together, what you found in the Shevis Achim records from a block away?
It wasn't Shevis Achim. It was actually B'nai Abraham, which later merged with Beker Holim to become Beker Holim B'nai Avraham.
Oh.
And then later, in the 1950s, when Beker Holim B'nai Avraham merged with Shevis Achim B'nai Lubavitch, it became Beker Holim Shevis Achim. It's a very tangled
the whole
web.
History of that, yeah. And I remember there was one man who was that history. He died, I think, Mr. Krauser, who came from Eastern Europe in the late 40s after the Holocaust.
Right.
He became the shamus. His job every day was to be there every day for daily services, make sure there's a minion twice a day. And that when they moved the synagogue to Westville, he continued playing that role up until his death pretty much a few years ago.
That's right.
Pretty amazing story. So then you continued on your detective trail to try to prove.
And I was unsure how long the Gough Street mikveh lasted, and so I called Beth Wenger. Beth Wenger was also a graduate student at Yale in 1990 at Yale in history department. She's now gone on to be chairman of the Department of Jewish Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And I called her to find out whether the Gough Street mikveh was ever active. And she said, oh, absolutely. She said, I looked into that, and she didn't know whether the Ahavas Achos had merged their $500 with the Mishkan Israel 600 to build it. She said she no longer had her notes. After it was 26 years later, I was calling her. But she said there's no question but that the Gough Street mikveh lasted until at least 1890 when a new one was built on Oak Street. And she didn't know how many there were on Oak Street either.
So you confirmed. So there was at least one on Oak Street. Then you found a third one. And part of it you got through oral history. See, the historian has so many different tools. You had records of synagogues and other societies.
Yeah.
You had, other publications they put out. But then you found out about, I don't know how you found out about this in the first place. There was a mikveh society, and they built a third one on Day Street in the 1930s. Right. And the way you found out was that you heard that there was this woman named Ida Bat who went to the old Orr Street Shul, which has been revived.
That's right.
Orr Street Shul. And she, even though women weren't usually up at the Bima, she went up to the Bima and said that she wanted everyone to give money to build another mikveh. And the way you heard about this, and you confirmed it with her grandson,
Jay Krupnik,
who told them the story.
Yes.
But how did you hear about it the first time?
Jay Krupnik told me about it.
Oh, okay. And they built one. But how did you confirm that there was a mikveh on Day Street?
It sounded so unusual that I called Rabbi Feldman, the rabbi of...
For 50 years, he was the rabbi of Westville Synagogue.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he confirmed to me that he had not been present at it. He came later, but that he had spoken to some of the rabbis, his colleagues, and some of the older members of his congregation. And I asked him, did he know anything about that? And he spontaneously told me the same story that Jay Krupnik told me, based upon his knowledge from some of his older congregants and some of the older rabbis in the community.
But in addition to the story about the moment in the Orr Street Shul,
yes,
he also had colleagues who physically went to that mikveh.
That's absolutely.
And when did that go out of business?
That continued in business until 1977, when the area became less safe and the women were unwilling or reluctant to go to that
area. How did you find that out? How did you find out that that stopped, discontinued?
I spoke to the women.
Oh, you spoke to women who went to the...
Yes. There are still women alive who went there. They were reluctant to go there, and so they had a mikveh society led by Shirley Tracton, a daughter of Ida Bat, and Shirley Krupnik, also related to Mrs. Bat. And
they decided to build a new mikveh. And here's a story I really love. I just want to remind people that you're listening to High Haven, the show about everything Jewish in our community on WNHH Radio. We're talking about the new book, Jews in New Haven, Volume 10. And we're here with the editor of that book, Dr. David Fisher, who has devoted close to four decades to helping the New Haven Jewish community preserve its history and keep communal institutions going. We're talking about your detective work and doing this book about the history of the mikvahs. And so when did they build the Hubinger Street one?
1977.
And
it was
that when it opened?
Yeah. At 78, I think it opened.
And then what I loved about this story, this is what I love about reading Jews in New Haven, to see what we act like as Jews and how it continues and the kind of arguments we have. So here the Jews are going to build a new mikveh. They don't want to go to Day Street anymore. And they're about to build it. And then it turns out that within the Orthodox community, there are two groups, different groups of Orthodox people who have different ideas about how the mikveh should be built. So right. The Chabad movement in the Lubavitch Hasidism, they're the most growing part of Jewish community, I think, now in New Haven, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But back then in 77, they said that there should be, and you called it Bor al Gabai Bor.
In other words, a pool on top of a pool with a little connection between the two versus a pool, two pools, one next to each other with a connection. And the Day Street mikveh had been a pool adjacent to a pool with a connection between them. But the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe said he preferred a pool on top of a pool.
How do you do that? How do you build a pool? Two floors on a building?
Yeah, you build the lower portion first, and then you build a podium to support.
So the Lubavitch said, if you're going to build this,
build it our way.
We need to build it our way. The other Orthodox people said no. And why did the Orthodox people want to build it their way?
It would be cheaper.
Oh, cheaper. And they said, by the way, and I love this argument, the other side said, we've done it already that way in Day Street. You guys went to Day
you
Street.
You guys went
so
to Day
So the Lubavitch went to Day Street when it was side by side. So why are you insisting it has to be on top now? And the Lubavitch said, since we have a preference for on top and you would go either way, and that's often argument Jewish yes. communities, people who are the strictest interpretation of rules say, let's all go with the strictest interpretation because then everybody can participate. Yeah. And other people say, but sometimes there are others who don't abide for other reasons with the strictest way. So we always have to work out that, like with kashrut, you know, what kind of kosher rules are going to be for a meal. We often have those arguments. And so in the end, they built it the way that the non-Chabad said. They built it side by side because it was cheaper. So as a result, Chabad, I guess the Deutsch family put up their money for their own mikveh, and we got two mikvehs instead of one, and we got one at 16 Colony Road, correct?
That's correct.
And when did that open?
That opened a few years later.
And then there was a, and is that for women?
That's for women.
And then they built one for men on 300 Norton Street. When did that
yes.
open?
That opened when they, Yeshiva Gedola took over the building
from
on
Young
Norton
Israel?
Street. No, before they took over the Young Israel building, they established the Yeshiva Gedola.
Next to that building?
Yeah, next to that building. Two buildings.
And when was that?
That would have been, about 1998 or 2000, because they took over the Young Israel in 2005 and named it Yeshiva David Shlomo.
Okay.
In honor of Mr. Deitch.
Oh, that's very nice. And Dr. Fisher, so tell me, you're 87 years old.
Yep.
You're still mentally fit as a fiddle. Believe me, you are. You just did this great accomplishment of editing this book. You continue 3 days a week to co-chair Yale Cancer Center. You're an active person, contributing so much to the community. Why did you go on that quest to find out so much about the mikvah? Why did you devote so much time at this stage in your life to creating a solid historical record of the trajectory of ritual baths in New Haven?
Originally, I asked some women to write this story, and they didn't. It was supposed to be in Volume 9. In fact, in Volume 9, I mention it. That was one of the things that I was sorry that we did not accomplish. And when it came to Volume 10, I discovered that there had been a previous one, and the women who I had asked to write it didn't know about Mikveh 1 and Mikveh 2. They only knew about 3. And in fact, there's a bronze plaque in the Huber Street.
I was going to say that. So the current Mikveh at Huber Street has incorrect information you discovered
yes.
on that plaque.
Yes. And these were perfect. These were very good people. I mean, these are.
They just didn't know they'd been the first
that's
two.
That's right. These are real leaders of the Jewish community. I wrote about Trachten.
And they thought the first one was when?
They thought the first one was 1934. 35.
In Day Street.
Yeah.
Wow.
Day Street. They thought.
So 1863 was the first. The second was Oak Street when there was at least one, but we don't know what year. We just know it was the late 1800s.
Yeah, about 1890, roughly.
And then we know that 1937.
Day Street. And the Jewish Historical Society has the records of the Day Street. Constitution, the organization, they have they have the bill of sale, they have all of that. So the Jewish Historical Society has all that information.
Oh, so you didn't need the confirmation of the women who went there. You have the records.
Yeah, we have the records.
Okay, the records are...
But the interesting thing was Jay Krupnik's story of how his grandmother had started all this business in the most unusual way.
Because women normally didn't go up and speak at the Bima.
That's right.
That's an awesome story about the ritual baths. And, you know, there are other great stories here. We're not going to have time to go on a lot of them today, but another great parts of these books are stories about individuals. I talked about Samuel Kampner, Meyer Zunder. We learned about, there's a great long piece by Andy Horowitz about the Bagel family, the lenders, their whole history in the Hill and the different generations, starting with the cart becoming an international conglomerate. Right. And that's a wonderful early book. In this
book,
that's
in volume 9.
Yeah. Part of what struck me in this book, Dr. Fisher, was a story about women who are alive today who have done so much in the communal Jewish institutions. There are three in particular that stuck out for me. Rhoda Sachs Zoller Samuel, who a retired city official who grew up in West Hartford, became a single mom, did so much in city government for housing, child care, and transportation. And she's devoted so much of her time to the Historical Society. And she recently led a project, although she doesn't take much credit for it, with other ethnic historical societies, right, raised money, put together. We now have these walking tours of New Haven neighborhoods with Jewish history, African-American history, Irish-American, Italian-American.
Ukrainian-American.
Ukrainian-American. And that you can actually get booklets that they've published that just came out. You can read about them in New Haven Independent. You can also go on the internet. You can go in those neighborhoods and you get an audio and visual self-guided tour, including people who know about this, these buildings, talking about them when you go door to door. That's pretty amazing. The Jewish Historical Society is definitely in the 21st century and moving forward.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that in Volume 10, we do have a history of the first Jewish president of Yale University, Richard Levin.
And the second one,
Peter Salovey. And we also have a story about Joe Lieberman, the first vice president, Jewish candidate for vice president of the United States. And we have stories about several of the leaders of the Jewish Historical Society of New Haven.
Right. And the other two women I want to mention were Sidney Perry, who spent so many years running the Jewish Federation, the JCC, Macomb High School, Jewish continuing education, Jewish Education Department, and their wonderful tribute to her. And Judah Schiff, over 50 years throwing libraries, archivists, grew up here, went to Benton School, which is now Becky in Westville. She started also worked on the oral archives of the Holocaust and writes the history in your book here of the Jewish Historical Society and how she and others helped get that started.
And she's also the official historian of the city of New Haven.
Right. What a great cast of characters. Do you have before we close out here, do you have a favorite story in this edition?
There are so many favorite stories. One that I wrote was about the trip I took with Danny Fisher, who's since retired to Florida. When we went back, Danny survived Auschwitz and Dachau.
Concentration camps.
And we went back to Auschwitz together and Birkenau, where he was confined. And it was a very memorable occasion. And we said Kaddish there with a million collaborators.
Uh-huh. Dr. Fisher, David Fisher, congratulations on the publication of the 10th edition of Jews in New Haven. What a gift, what a mitzvah, and what a gift to our entire community. As one loyal reader of all these books, I can't thank you enough. You've enriched my life and made me feel more a part of my community.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Just go to the web, folks, Jewish Historical Society of Greater New Haven. You can get the book through them. And I want to thank you for listening to WNHH Radio's High Haven. Thanks to today's guest, David S. Fisher. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it with us all week long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.